This is Fresh Air. By the late 1920s, phonographs and radio broadcasts carried new kinds of music to all but the most rural reaches of our country. Local folk musicians were influenced by these new sounds, and in turn, folk elements showed up in newly written, copyrighted songs. So-called hillbilly records were selling in the South, and jazz aficionados here and abroad bought up sounds of the country blues. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has learned that the first inklings of the meld we now call country music could be heard early in the decade.
In June 1922, two men wearing Confederate uniforms appeared at the Victor Company in New York. Brandishing a couple of fiddle cases, they demanded to be recorded, and to humor them, the folks at Victor agreed. That afternoon, Henry C. Gilliland and Eck Robertson became America's first country music stars. But even though their record of Arkansas Traveler and Sally Gooden sold far better than anybody'd expected, Victor wasn't convinced they should try any more of this stuff. Instead, it was a young man named Ralph Peer, working for the OK Record Company in Chicago, who set off the boom by discovering and recording Fiddlin' John Carson in Atlanta in 1923. Carson's record sold very well indeed, and soon both Columbia and Victor were offering mountain music, as they called it. Victor had the first million seller in 1925 with Vernon Dalhart, a Dallas-bred New Yorker who'd sung opera, and suddenly the company got very interested. Ralph Peer went to work for Victor shortly thereafter. If the country music industry could be said to have a birthday, it would be the 2 weeks between July 21st and August 5th, 1927. Ralph Peer, armed with the latest electrical recording equipment, set up at 408 State Street in Bristol on the Tennessee-Virginia state line.
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Are you like in the blood of the Lamb? Are you fully trusting in His grace this hour? Are you like in the blood of the Lamb? Are you like in the blood, in the soul cleansing blood of the Lamb? Are your garments spotless as they white as snow? Are you like in the blood of the Lamb?
Ernest Stoneman was a local musician Peer had worked with before, and he'd helped Peer book the first week's worth of sessions. He also helped Peer with the second week by letting a local journalist observe the recording sessions and write in the subsequent story that Stoneman was making $100 a day, his musicians $25 a day, and that in the past year, Stoneman's recordings had netted him $3,600. That did the trick. Out of the hills they came, toting fiddles, harmonicas, guitars, and banjos. Peer loved what he called holy roller music and was delighted to discover Ernest Phipps.
I want to go, Lord, I want to go. I want to go where Jesus is. I want to go where Jesus is. Lord, I want to go where Jesus is.
He also realized that such stuff had limited commercial potential and was very happy when, on August 1st, Mr. and Mrs. Carter from Mesa Springs, Virginia showed up. Peer had mentioned to Carter that he'd like to record him, but somehow nothing had happened. Now, not only had A.P. Carter and his wife Sarah shown up, but they'd brought along Sarah's 18-year-old guitar-playing sister, Maybelle.
My heart is sad and I'm in sorrow for the only one I love. When shall I see him? Oh, no, never till I meet him in heaven above. Oh, bear me yonder,
Peer loved the interplay the family got with their voices and instruments, but he was particularly taken with Sarah's voice and arranged for her to do a solo session the next day.
Thank you.
Maybelle's distinctive outlining of the melody on the bass strings of her guitar became the Carter family's signature. But there was trouble with another group Pierre had been depending on. The Tenava Ramblers were immensely popular in the area, especially now that they'd added a young singer from Mississippi on banjo. Now that they were going to record, though, he wanted special credit on the record label, and the other guys weren't going for it. The night before the session, they threw him out of the band, recruited another banjo player, and taught him the next day's songs.
The longest train that I ever saw was on that Georgia line. The engine passed at 6 o'clock, and the cab it passed at 9.
At 2 o'clock, the fired banjoist showed up with a small guitar and asked to audition for Pierre. Pierre wasn't too sure. Most of what the guy had been doing was contemporary pop material, but he had a gimmick that might work. Jimmy Rogers only cut two sides that day, and only one had his trademark yodeling on it. But as it turned out, that was all rural America needed to hear to start demanding more. Pierre recorded many other musicians during those weeks in Bristol, but it was the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers who went on to establish what eventually wound up being called country music as a viable commercial entity. The songs they recorded were written, copyrightable, not folk music. And while more traditional recordings continued to sell, the Carters and Rogers gave a glimpse of the future. If you'd like to hear more of the Bristol Sessions, you can get the fascinating record I used for this piece from the Country Music Foundation at 4 Music Square East, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203.
I'm glad Ed Ward has his curiosity. That address again is the Country Music Foundation, 4 Music Square East, Nashville, Tennessee, 37203. Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air.